KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, an hour all about the burgeoning world of social entrepreneurship. We'll hear from author John Elkington, who has co-authored a book on the subject, and we'll talk with three Bay Area social entrepreneurs who are forging new pathways by turning profit from entrepreneurship tied to human welfare and social good. Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. In this hour, we want to explore the world of social entrepreneurship. It's rapidly growing, and it's a form of business enterprise tied to being green, environmentally useful, or to larger concerns of social or global nature. And we've brought together an author who's written a book on the subject, as well as three young Bay Area social entrepreneurs who have distinguished themselves in the field. And let me introduce you to whom we've assembled here in studio. I want to welcome, first of all, John Elkington, who is co-founder and chief entrepreneur with Sustainability, an international consulting firm. He's also co-author with Pamela Hartigan of The Power of Unreasonable People, How Social Entrepreneurs Create Markets That Change the World. Welcome, John Elkington.
Thanks, Michael.
Good to have you. Also good to have Eric Grossberg, who's co-founder and CEO of Brilliant Earth, an ethical diamond jeweler offering conflict-free diamonds. We'll find out what that's all about in the course of this hour. Eric, welcome.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Glad to have you, and glad to have Stephanie Bernstein, founder and – is it Bernstein or Bernstein?
Bernstein.
Founder and CEO of To-Go-Ware, which makes reusable food and beverage containers and other products, and we welcome you.
Thanks.
And Matt Flannery is also with us here in studio, co-founder and CEO of Kiva.org. It's a person-to-person micro-lending website, which empowers individuals to lend directly to unique entrepreneurs in the developing world. And welcome, Matt Flannery.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Glad to have you all here. And I'm going to begin with John Elkington so we can get the lay of the land and general find out what he's come to conclude about these unreasonable people. Unreasonable as in George Bernard Shaw, yes?
Absolutely.
Yeah. You might explain that or annotate that first.
Well, he just said that reasonable people tend to adapt themselves to the world as they find it. Unreasonable people don't. They tend to push the envelope slightly. And therefore, he said all progress tends to depend on the unreasonable man. I'm sorry, that's the word he used, but
well,
these people don't take the world as they find
it. In a sexist era that he was in, that's understandable. But we're talking, of course, about men and women here. And we're also talking about changing the world, literally, mm-hmm. huh? As you see it.
Well, I think we are. And I think one of the things that's been quite striking in the last decade is how a whole series of issues, most notably at the moment climate change, but poverty and a raft of other issues have been coming up onto the international agenda. So for the last 7 or 8 years, for example, I've gone to the World Economic Forum meetings. The first time I went was in 2002 after the 9/11 attacks. The event was held in New York. And we held a meeting there and tried to get all of the mainstream business people and political leaders and so on to come to a session on social entrepreneurs. And almost no one turned up. I mean, they simply didn't know what this field was all about. Now we've had three entrepreneurs, social or environmental, most recently Al Gore, but before that Muhammad Yunus of Grameen, and before that Wangari Maathai of the Greenbelt movement in East Africa.
Three of the major inspirers of this.
Absolutely. So people are beginning to get a sense of what this is all about.
And you've got also a whole new generation who are more global-minded, yep. who have been inspired by the kind of figures that you've named. But you also have really kind of a new business model here, don't we?
I think one of the key factors has been the new economy period. I mean, yes, it went bang at a certain point in time, but many of the people who made money in that era have come out with a lot of money and are starting to invest it. I mean, Bill Gates probably at the top of the pile, but people like Jeff Skoll and others have put money into entrepreneurs, and they're looking, they're helping these people create businesses in a very different way.
New models, new markets, but when you talk about changing the world, that sounds pretty vast and extraordinary.
I think we have to be very careful about loading a whole bunch of expectations on these sort of fairly early stage entrepreneurs around the world. I mean, that they have to be build organizations, they have to build businesses. It'll take quite some time to do that. If we expect them to do all the things that Al Gore and others are setting up for us, God help them.
Well, we're going to find out about how these businesses have been built. In fact, in the case of Stephanie Bernstein, after Inconvenient Truth came out, what, your business went up about 300%?
Yeah.
Something like that. We should mention that that number 300 came up to me a couple of times, because if you take all of these things that are throwaway in ours, like napkins and spoons and cups and whatnot, you go around the equator 300 times?
Yeah, Americans toss away enough plastic forks, knives, and spoons each year to circle the equator 300 times.
So thus we have the to-go-ware, I mean, your company. And it's essentially a company... started at the University of Michigan. My daughter went there around the same time. I even remembered Stooshies was the place. It was an ice cream place you were in, yeah?
Yeah, I was a student in college, and I was a theater major. I wasn't thinking in terms of a business at the time, but we sat down. We ordered a dish of ice cream. I was with my sister and her husband, and they served us a plastic bowl and a plastic spoon. And I said, did we say to go? And it was a time where you could feel the shift happening from establishments going towards disposables rather than just serving you. Now you don't think twice about it because pretty much everywhere you go has that. So being sort of an idealistic college student, and we carried our mugs everywhere more because they gave us a discount everywhere if we brought a mug in rather than it being a green thing. I was just like, well, why don't we carry everything everywhere? And thought of the name to-go-ware, and then thought about it for 7 years and did a whole bunch of other things, and then got really involved in the natural products lifestyle in the industry, became a yoga instructor and a foodie. And then when all the compostable materials came out, I started to really couldn't drop the idea. And then we started to find some great products.
You were one of these unreasonable people that John Elkington writes about. You were possessed by an idea for 7 years. Huh?
You can't help, you know, it just was the idea that wouldn't die. So after a while, it seemed like the timing and the you know, after I was on the East Coast for a while, when I moved to the Bay Area, and there was such a ripe and vibrant environmental community here, people to actually, you know, not think, well, that's a crazy idea, but people who were like, I'd buy one.
So what are you selling? I mean, you're making things essentially to keep the stuff that's been going to landfills all this, low these many years, out of the landfills. What do we have?
Well, the idea behind to-go-ware is to offer non-plastic, reusable options for whether you're bringing your own food with you or you're taking food to go from an establishment. So we do a reusable utensil set made out of bamboo, and we have a cotton wrap that's made from a women's cooperative in a Burmese refugee camp on the Thai-Burma border.
I hope they weren't hit by the cyclone.
I was just looking at the map today, and I'm actually very concerned, so yeah, I was going to call them because it's
major, 4,000 people.
It's right there. So I know there were heavy rains in a close town. So.
And I'm glad you still say Burma rather than Myanmar. But
yes.
This is Weave?
Weave, yes. Yeah. Yes, it's a women's cooperative. It works with a specific hill tribe on the Thai-Burma border called the Karen. And then, we also bring in a stainless steel food carrier, traditionally known as tiffin boxes, and those are from India. And so the idea is basically, again, just to give people durable, reusable options, things that they'll purchase and hopefully have with them for a very long time.
Again, Stephanie Bernstein is founder and CEO of To-Go-Ware, and they make reusable food and beverage containers as well as other products. Eric Grossberg is co-founder and CEO of Brilliant Earth. That's an ethical diamond jeweler, and they make conflict-free diamonds. Now, conflict-free diamonds, at least according to the UN definition, simply means if they're financing a civil war, it's conflict, or if they're involved in a rebel movement, something along those lines. But your definition goes a little broader than that, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. What we do is we look at all of the different social issues that are involved in diamonds. So there are a lot of labor and environmental issues that are really not encompassed by the UN definition of conflict diamonds. And those are things like child labor and slave labor. You have 1 million diamond diggers in Africa that are working for less than $1 a day. And we feel that that's not acceptable. Even if this isn't a UN definition of a civil war, it still should be a diamond that's coming from a clean place.
You also have these open mines with all that cyanide coming out in Africa. So you're avoiding all this environmental pollution, too.
So there are a lot of environmental issues for diamond mining. The cyanide and mercury are specifically involved in gold mining. And so we use fully recycled gold to address those environmental issues.
You go to Africa to some extent, but most of this comes from Canada. Yeah.
So our diamonds today are primarily from Canada. It's one of the few places in the world today where you can track the diamond back from the mine of origin, know that it's mined, cut, polished, all with fair labor practices and all in an environmentally responsible way.
Of course, environmentally responsible way can be subjective or can be at least ambiguous in some respects, no?
I would say so. We're talking about extractive industries. And so when you are in an extractive industry, there tends to be some level of footprint. These aren't zero footprint activities. But from our perspective, the best you can do is to really minimize the impact, make sure that the environmental planning is done in a very comprehensive way and done in accordance with the desires of local people that have issues, they have agriculture, they have fishing.
Indigenous people.
Indigenous people, yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
And you follow the whole chain of custody, huh?
We do. We do. We follow the diamonds every step of the way, make sure they're tracked every step of the way so that you can't switch it out. You know that the practices are responsible, the whole path.
And renewal of metals like gold and platinum and the like?
Exactly. So metals, the issues are very intense. So you have a lot of cyanide and mercury are used in gold mining in lots of parts of the world. And there's very little regard for pollution into local water supplies and also no regard for the indigenous people in those areas. So these people aren't protected. They don't receive any cut of the revenue. So from our perspective, the most efficient way to do that is to use fully recycled metal. You're talking about gold and platinum, which can be recycled an infinite number of times. And if you do that, you can actually minimize the need for new gold mining and more environmental impact from that.
So this is a process that you can track. You can't track as well in Africa. In fact, it's very hard to track in Africa. That's the problem with getting diamonds from Africa, I presume.
Yeah, so we actually are involved in a number of projects to do basically pilot projects for fair trade diamonds in Africa. It is a really challenging exercise.
That's why you're kicked out of Botswana now? Do I have that right?
Yeah, I have been banned from traveling to Botswana as a result of...
It's a badge of pride because you're going to the essentially defense of the Kalahari Bushmen, I think, right?
Exactly. Yeah, so there was an issue where you had Bushmen in that country were being moved off their land, basically so that diamond mining could take place there. They were receiving no compensation, and it's their ancestral land that they've been in for a very, very long period of time. And one of the activities that we were doing is advocating on their behalf, and as a result, I was told that I was not welcome.
So this is to protect indigenous people and also to protect, caribou and wildlife and fish water habitats and so forth. What about the argument that by doing it the way you do it, you keep people from work in Africa?
Well, I think that argument gets made over and over again. I think the problem with that argument is the alternative is to do nothing. So if we say, well, you know, on the off chance that I might be stopping, you know, a good diamond coming from good sources in Africa, I'm going to buy any diamond from Africa. What I'm effectively doing is perpetuating lots of bad practices and saying that I don't care that a lot of these diamonds might be coming from places where there's child labor or slave labor or other violence, or I don't care that this person might be making less than a dollar a day and working in very unsafe conditions. So from our perspective, only when you put your foot down and say, okay, I'm going to ensure that this is coming from a clean place, can you start to affect real change.
Again, we're talking to Eric Grossberg, co-founder and CEO of Brilliant Earth, and that business started when his partner got engaged, and they thought, where did this diamond come from, I guess, and decided to trace it. Matt Flannery is with us. In fact, his business got started in Africa, in Uganda. He's co-founder and CEO of Kiva.org. It's a person-to-person micro-lending website, and they're now lending to alleviate poverty in 40 countries, and also got a good deal of attention because he was on Oprah, thanks to Bill Clinton, and suddenly this business has taken off. Micro-lending all over the world, really, aren't you?
Yeah, we're lending to people in 40 countries right now. It's grown really, really fast.
A lot of Azerbaijan, I noticed, in Mexico. I actually went down and noticed where you were lending to. But let's talk about what you do. For example, you essentially connect people for microlending, basically, right?
Right. So the vision of Kiva is to connect people through lending to alleviate poverty. So we're really focused on that person-to-person loan.
And what do they find, for example, when they go to your website?
When you go to our website, you'll see people from many different nationalities, including Azerbaijan, that are looking for a loan. People, generally low-income people in poverty, looking for a small loan to help cycle out of poverty.
How do you screen? Because you've got all these would-be entrepreneurs. You know, I get letters almost daily from Kenya and places like that, as I'm sure you do on the internet, saying, you know, all you have to do is put your money here and we'll make you a fortune. There's a real screening process that you go through, isn't there?
Yeah, well, when we started, it was just my wife and I in Uganda actually screening the people ourselves, but that wasn't very scalable. So what we did was we latched onto the microfinance movement. There are microfinance institutions all over the world that are lending money for a social cause. So Grameen Bank is the most popular, most famous.
Oh, and won the Nobel Prize, too. Mohammed
right. Abba, but there are actually organizations like that in almost every country now. So we're letting them use our website to raise money to their micro borrowers.
This is a pretty data-rich and transparent lending program, at least that's what you're aiming for, but the track record and measuring or quantifying your successes versus your failures, how does that work?
Well, many things are easy to track. So repayment rates, easy to track. Total loan volume, we've loaned about almost $30 million now with a 99% repayment rate. What's more difficult to track is the social impact of a microloan. We all know, we all feel in our heart that microfinance is really contributing to alleviation of poverty, but it's very difficult to prove that. And so that's one thing the whole industry is working on right now.
The whole industry has come under criticism recently. There was an article in The New Yorker, maybe a backlash of some degree, but suggesting that microloan has gotten too much hype and really doesn't help poor countries. It may help individuals in poor countries, but in terms of the national wealth or the national standards, it's a drop in the ocean. What do you say to that?
Well, I think you have to think what you're really trying to do. Are you trying to affect the GDP of Peru, or are you trying to help 1,000 people in a village in Peru alleviate get out of poverty? And so I really think of microfinance as the main goal is to alleviate poverty, not necessarily increase the GDP of countries. Not to say that it can't, but it's not proven to do so very well.
What do you do about currency rates and for that matter, inflated repayments?
Hey, it's a big problem. In the last few years, you know, we've seen the depreciation of the dollar, and that's really helped the entrepreneurs on our site because they actually repay in dollars, and so by the time they repay their loan, it's less. But you can imagine that shift changing. So what we're doing is trying to allow local currency lending on our website so you can actually lend to someone in Ugandan shillings and get paid back in Ugandan shillings. But that's difficult to do in about 40 countries.
That's a vexing problem, yeah. Well,
yeah.
But you're learning on the job sort of with this, I guess, case by case.
Right. I never thought I'd have to start tackling these problems. There's a lot of exotic currencies out
there. You give yourself the letter CEO, that's what happens. So again, Matt Flannery is co-founder and CEO of Kiva.org. John Elkington, you heard these three stories of our own Bay Area social entrepreneurs. These are the kind of people you're writing about in your book.
They are. And just to pick up the point, Michael, on it's not microfinance isn't making a big impact on economies of some of these countries. You've got in the Bay Area an organization, Kickstart. Martin Fisher and Nick Moon are involved in that. And they very much operate in East Africa. And if you look at how much of a contribution they're now making, for example, to the Kenyan economy, it's about 1% of the Kenyan economy. So it's still incredibly small. But if you look at where these people started from, it's coming through quite powerfully. And I think, for me, one of the absolutely crucial elements of all of this is not just what these individual entrepreneurs, and I love them to pieces, are doing. That's incredibly important. But it is the sense that people can do things themselves to make the world a better place. And I think very often in the last sort of 30 years or so, people have subcontracted their consciences to NGOs. I'm not against that. I mean, a lot of the NGOs do really great work. But one of the things I like, for example, about Kiva is that you can, as an individual, almost take an investment approach to it. You don't subcontract the process to an NGO. You actually decide who you support, and then you watch that if you choose to do so. A lot of people don't watch their stocks, so you know they might ignore this side as well. But it's opening up the process in a way that I think is hugely powerful. And over a period of time, I think that could have a catalytic effect. which will be even more significant than just the sort of the sum of the component parts.
Well, the real message for you seems to be individuals can make a difference and make a real difference.
Yeah, I think, again, we have to be very careful not sort of to dump every responsibility in the world, social, environmental, economic, governance, whatever, in these people's laps. I think what we've got to work out is how these sort of social and environmental entrepreneurs can be linked up in sensible ways to government actors, public sector agencies, companies and so on, because it's only when you bring constellations of actors together and that you can really deal with some of these very big problems.
Does that potentially diminish government's responsibility?
I think government's got to reinvent itself. No, I think a lot of what is going on at the moment is that stuff that used to be done by governments is being unintentionally spun out to a bunch of other actors. I think that's great because you get reinvention of the functions of government over a period of time. But at some stage, you've got to take some of that back into the public sphere, because companies often say, you know, there was a moment when we loved doing all of this new social and environmental stuff. Then we suddenly realize, well, it's not just a resources issue. We're not elected to do this stuff. And some of this stuff is deeply political. So at some stage, I think governments and political leaders have got to wade back into the fray.
John Elkington, again, is co-founder and chief entrepreneur of Sustainability, an international consulting firm, and co-author with Pamela Hartigan of The Power of Unreasonable People, How Social Entrepreneurs Create Markets That Change the World. A couple of minutes from break here, I want to ask each of you, Matt Flannery, I want to start out with you. I mean, I can hear practical-minded people say, well, this is really good work, but can you make enough money to live in the Bay Area?
Barely, but we're doing it. We're running it like a business. We send 100% of your money to the entrepreneur you fund, but we also ask you for a 10% tip. And just on those tips alone, we're basically breaking even. So it's really amazing when you get so many people from the internet to lend money all at once. You can actually just make enough to run a small organization in the Bay Area.
10% is pretty kind, considering now standard, at least in restaurants, to give a 15% tip, I think. Eric Grossberg, what about you?
Well, I would say, as any entrepreneur, it is a little bit hard in the early days, but our model, I think, is one that it's very good alignment between the social mission and the business itself, and as a result, we're growing quickly and are profitable, and I think it hopefully will be possible to afford to live here in the long term.
And Stephanie Bernstein?
Well, I don't live too high on the hog, but we're getting, our business is growing so quickly. We are at approximately a break-even point, but we are an inventory-based business, and we do import all our goods from overseas. So, you know, we do purchase far ahead, and growth is good, but growth definitely presents some challenges.
Now, how often do you go to Thailand? Burma, I mean, excuse me.
I was there last year, actually, for the first time. The camp is on the border of Thailand and Burma, and it's been there for about 15 years, and there's over 50,000 people currently living there. It was a remarkable experience, and I had a sense we were about to have the growth that we had last year, which is why I made the trip there, and I really wanted to meet these women and to make sure that they were interested in sewing lots and lots of utensil holders for us and some other products we have them doing. And they wanted to sew anything because they're really not able to come and go from the camp freely. They have no source of income that they can really generate for themselves. So
you're really helping ameliorate poverty.
Well, we're...
To a degree.
Yeah, we're just trying to, you know, and we also get that question of, are you trying to, you know, how much, what percentage of this product do you donate back to the women? And, you know, I'm like, the women are paid in full far before the product reached your hands. And what we're trying to do is create a long-term sustainable income for these women and give them job skills and, not, you know, teach a man to fish rather than
provide the
exactly.
fish.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to provide our phone number because I know there are many of you who would like to jump aboard here, and we welcome your phone calls. Talking about social entrepreneurship, what about your thoughts about it, reflections about it, some of you who are probably involved in it? And that's the topic here, so feel free to join us. Our toll-free number, you may have questions for any of our guests or just comments that you want to offer. Our toll-free number, and it's available to you whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Join the program at 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, and we'll continue with your calls and emails with John Elkington from Sustainability, Eric Grossberg from Brilliant Earth, Stephanie Bernstein from To Go Where, and Matt Flannery from Kiva.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about really new generation of social entrepreneurs and what sets them apart, and talking with sustainable business consultant John Elkington and three Bay Area entrepreneurs motivated by environmental concerns and concerns about social equity. Matt Flannery is co-founder and CEO of Kiva.org, and Stephanie Bernstein, founder and CEO of To Go Aware, and Eric Grossberg is co-founder and CEO of Brilliant Earth. John Elkington, again, is co-author of The Power of Unreasonable People, How Social Entrepreneurs Create Markets That Change the World. I wanted to ask each of our social entrepreneurs that we've assembled this hour about some of the major challenges. You were hinting at them before when I asked, you know, about profit and scaling upward and those kinds of things. But what else? Eric, you want to talk about major challenges you faced? And you've been at it how long now?
About 3 years. Yeah, I would say initially one of the hardest things was actually finding the supply that we used. We're talking about ethical origin, diamond jewelry products and jewelry products. And this was pretty new. And going out there and being able to qualify suppliers that could provide that to us was quite challenging. We were lucky to be able to piggyback on some of the efforts that were done up with some of the Canadian diamonds, but that was one of the biggest things getting started, was being able to find reliable sources of supply.
Matt, what would you put up there as a big challenge?
I'd say at first it was, you know, for the first couple of years, it's just inactivity, trying to convince everyone that this idea will work and it's not crazy. And yes, I am unreasonable, but that's okay. And then more so lately, once we've had some success, I think managing the success and keeping fraud out of the system, we've encountered fraud and all the, you know, work in 40 countries. So just combating that constantly is another big challenge.
Yeah, and you know, we did a program, Eric, on diamonds that can be created now. I mean, created literally molecularly. It's not zircon. It's real diamonds.
Actually. Right, yeah. Right. Actually, that was one of the products that we considered carrying early on. And what we found is men generally are a little bit afraid to buy them. They're afraid about how they're going to be perceived. And so we're happy to offer it when people are more interested to buy it. But so far, demand has been a little bit slow to come on that front.
And Stephanie, since you were the one who mentioned challenges, what have you found as the major challenges?
Oh, we have so many, but they all have a gift. But I would say one thing we had early on is just getting our compliance and certifications in order. You know, we work with a women's cooperative, and it's fair trade, and we feel good about our practices there, but we also bring in manufactured goods. And what we've really seen is that there's a broad spectrum of certifying bodies and different types of manufacturing compliance, and it's really hard to keep consistent from country to country and to find something that makes everyone feel that it's, you know, there's ISO certifications, but a lot of people feel that that's, well, you know.
ISO stands for?
It's a standard that looks at, there's certain levels of it that look at the manufacturing standards, and there are certain other levels that also look at the environment of the factory that you're working in. So we work with stainless steel manufacturing in India. We work with bamboo manufacturing, and to find that to just do the auditing and get proof of what we need to know to feel good about. But we don't have a good yardstick because there's not, you know, and there's also misconceptions. People come up to us and want to know if our stainless steel is fair trade. And there's no such thing as fair trade. It does not apply. And there's no, for stainless steel, for manufactured goods. It's more towards
steel, yeah,
like handicrafts, right, and agricultural commodities. So it's, I know that when somebody comes up to me and wants to know, is this fair trade? What they're asking me, is this an ethically sourced item? Yeah. And we want to ensure that that is.
Let me go to our callers, and Ted, we'll begin with you. Good morning, Ted.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am in the pre-venture capitalist stage of an environmental consulting startup, and one of our major focuses is going to be the promotion of local businesses. And I'm just curious, particularly with Stephanie's company, I understand that you're trying to lift up this village in Burma out of poverty. But I'm wondering why you don't find similar buffs that can be made here in the U.S., or particularly here in the Bay Area.
Well, a lot of the way we've grown has been sort of by accident. We started by just sourcing things that were out there. We were looking for a good reusable food carrier. We were looking for a great source of a material for utensils, which is why we chose bamboo. And we accidentally found the holders from the women's cooperative. So we became an import business sort of by default, and then we were really excited about the quality and the sustainable aspects of those materials. And, you know, we worked with Burma, and that was wonderful. So we've also just started a new project with a group in Delhi. That's an NGO, and they're making products from recycled plastic bags. They're working with people in the slums who collect trash. They collect the plastic, and then they turn it into another material. I would love to find a stainless steel manufacturer in the Bay Area to make our products and take the headache away from importing. But to be quite honest, it doesn't exist here.
It's hard to find even stainless steel manufacturers in Pittsburgh nowadays. I mean, with what's happened to manufacturing in this country. We can go to some more calls here, and let's get Eileen on. Eileen, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. This is mostly directed towards Kiva, but thank you, everybody, for your efforts. I'm not sure. I wasn't listening to your whole show just yet. I just got in the car and started listening to it in my biodiesel car. And I'm looking to see if, with Kiva, I need my investments to actually get a return, even though I haven't done any big investments yet. I'm wondering if, does Kiva have the potential to give a return? Because I'm into investing locally, and this seems like a local investment in sorts. Can you answer that? Did you get a question there yet?
Well, you've just asked it. Matt Flannery?
Great question. The short answer is, in the short term, no. The investments are 0% loans. In the long term, I believe they will provide a return. When we started out in Uganda, we actually had interest rates on the website, but took them off out of fear that some people in black suits would show up at my door shutting us down because of some securities regulation or investment laws that we weren't complying with. So we'll get there, just not in the next few months.
And thank you, Eileen, for your call and your question. And let me go back to John Elkington. Talk about return and profit. It keeps coming up sort of interwoven throughout this discussion. Let's look at some, because you highlight many examples here, something that's really been quite demonstrative in terms of profit or return in this whole world.
There's this spectrum that runs through from people who are addressing complete abject market failure, where no one's going to make money anytime in the foreseeable future, right the way through to people who are sort of headed for IPOs. I mean, the whole sort of clean technology sector would be an example of that. But in the middle, there are people who are trying to redefine value and trying to Eileen's question, not look for different forms of return that you might get from any particular investment that you might make. So
too bad you can't put social capital in the bank, huh?
Well, you can't yet, but there are people starting to look at concepts like blended value and so on, and it's not beyond the realm of possibility that governments can reshape markets.
We're talking about it in conjunction with climate change and global warming. Yeah. Any real success story here, though, just from a business standpoint or from a remunerative standpoint?
Well, let me take one that sort of straddles both the abject market failure through to the mainstream business space. Yeah. There's a woman in India called Juru Bilimoria. She set up an organization called Child Helpline, which helps street children. It provides a hotline service for them, and that went into 40-plus cities, has now been taken on by the government. She then took that international with Child Helpline International. But what really interests me is what she's doing now, which is she set up something called Child Savings International, or Aflatun. It's based in Amsterdam. And what they're basically doing is helping young children, not just in India, and in over a dozen countries now around the world, get into the habits of saving, even if they don't themselves have money. So it's trying to break that cycle of poverty. So to bring it back to the point around, so who makes a profit in all of this? What's starting to happen is some of the very big banks are starting to see real interest in terms of market development, customer development in this sort of area. So they're backing Aflatun. And I think that that's where I see this sort of hybrid value creation process being so important. The banks will probably make the profit, Juru won't, but there's a catalytic effect there that I think she would find useful.
Well, we're going to go to more of your calls. And again, you're welcome to join us in discussion here toll-free at 866-733-6786 or by email, forum@kqed.org. And Peter, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a contributor to a local organization called Village Enterprise Fund. Actually, some of the Kiva founders initially started some of their efforts with VEF, and the reason I'm bringing this up is that they focus on grants, not loans, and they focus on grants to those who are below the poverty line. So I'd like to insert this concept grants versus loans as a very effective way to alleviate poverty.
What about grants versus loans, Matt Flannery?
I think there's a place for all of the above. Certainly, grants can definitely help many people, mostly the abject poor, and certainly loans can help many people as well, often the more entrepreneurial middle poor. And there's a lot of crossover in between. So I don't think it's a question of either or. I think we're all doing our part in trying to tackle world poverty.
And I thank the caller. John Elkington, some advice from you about a number of people out there who want to know, where do I begin and how do I begin to do something along the lines of what we're hearing here as a paradigm?
Well, you know, tomorrow I'm doing a session at the Haas Business School in Berkeley. And one of the things that's really striking at the moment is the way that business school students are just switching on to this social entrepreneurship space at an extraordinary rate. The faculty are really struggling.
That's you,
to
Eric Grossberg, right?
The inspiration actually started while I was in business school.
Sorry, John, please.
But again, I think one of the things we have to be very careful not to do is to say that there is one bunch of extraordinary people, and these are the social entrepreneurs, the sort of extraordinary people we have in the studio today. There are people like this popping up in all sorts of different areas. So, for example, later on today at IDEO here in San Francisco, we launch a new report which looks at what we call the social intrapreneur, the people inside mainstream companies who are actually learning from the social entrepreneurs and are starting to do similar sorts of things from within companies. And I think that's really important, because one of the things that we found in talking to the social entrepreneurs is they are desperate to make contacts, connections with mainstream business. And what we're saying to them, actually, there are people like you inside some of these big companies. These are they, and these are some of the ways in which you might develop a
conversation. There's an idea for a social entrepreneur, how to match these up.
Absolutely, dating agency.
Yeah, like a dating agency, right, exactly. Well, we're going to bring some more of our callers in. And from Berkeley, Peter joins us. Hi, Peter.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for the show. Two ideas. One, a Grameen Bank kind of model to loan legal fees to poor people where they would normally not qualify for a contingency lawyer. That requires a certain amount of meat on the bone, so to speak. And so many people get ground under and cannot get legal services. But a fund set up specifically to loan small amounts to people to protect themselves under the law and then get repaid, and maybe even with a premium that would make the fund grow. I think that's a really important idea, because it would bring justice to a whole class of people that often gets iced out. And the second idea would be some kind of national government web portal linked up with a national service requirement for people graduating from college.
Well, what do you think about the first idea, Matt Flannery?
I think there's a lot of good ideas out there, and people that think of them should go ahead and do them. So I exhort you, caller, I forgot, is it Peter?
Yeah.
Peter, please go do that. We could use it.
And the portal idea, John Elkington, how does that sound?
Well, I think it's difficult. I don't think each of us can go out and do the ideas that we've come up with. I think there are elements of this already out there. In my own country, the UK, you'll find a group called the Environmental Law Foundation who do some elements of this. There's a social entrepreneur in Asia called Karen Tsai, who's actually providing legal services to people in desperate circumstances. So I think there is the nucleus of a very, very good idea here. What we see at the moment is little bits and pieces of the answer to this, but it would be fantastic to have a portal that pulled together various of these initiatives and gave them real oomph.
Well, I thank Peter for the call. Would you agree, Stephanie Bernstein, those who want to move in this direction or find themselves with an idea that, I think as Matt said, just go out and do it, huh?
I completely agree, because, you know, I had a crazy idea and it took a while for it to gestate and to actually happen. But it's been remarkable for me to see the moment you have a crazy idea, then years later, how, not that it actually exists, but the ways in which it created itself. And I think the reason why social entrepreneurship is so exciting, and when you're working with people in other countries and trying to empower them, is because really we do have a lot more within ourselves, and the idea of taking responsibility away from governments or making it their responsibility to solve our problems or to create the solutions. And really, very often, it's just empowering one individual to make them realize that they can change the way they live. They can start whether it's a business or a movement, it's often a lot more empowering than a handout.
Well, we keep coming back to that power of the individual, but Eric Grossberg, well, going to the Haas Business School helped you, though, I think you're implying, aren't you?
Actually, Stanford in my case.
I'm sorry, Stanford, yeah.
But yeah.
John's going to be at the Haas Business School this afternoon. There are people who actually take great umbrage when you confuse those two schools. But
yes.
So, I mean, a Stanford MBA helped you sort of design everything and move in this direction?
It definitely did. I think a lot of the skills you need to build up a successful social enterprise are the same skills you need to build up any enterprise. And I guess one caveat I'd have, not that I would ever want to dissuade anybody from starting something that would go and create positive change, but one caveat is that this is hard work. And I think a lot of people believe that because you have a strong social mission and because you're doing such good things, well, everything is just going to fall into place and it's going to be easy and everyone's going to jump on the bandwagon from day one. And it's really not the case.
You know, I was just reviewing an interview I did a few years ago with Wangari Maathai, whose name was mentioned here, you know, who's responsible for planting thousands and thousands of trees in Kenya and getting poor women to do the planting. Remarkable woman who won the Nobel Prize. And she said one of the things in her autobiography and that we talked about that shocked her the most was when she came up with this idea that people weren't just flocking around her and responding, you know, with great kind of passion, the kind of passion that she felt that should have been infectious and all that.
She did have one of the most corrupt regimes in recent history, the Moy family, to deal with.
Indeed, and that's true, and that was part of the problem. But she also thought that there would be just it was tied to democracy later, which presented even more problems, but that there would be much more of a response. The challenges are there in that respect. Dean writes a question for you, Eric, for the Brilliant Earth Person. How are your maybe you won't want to answer this. I don't know. How are your suppliers for diamonds and recycle? Who are your suppliers for diamonds and recycled gold? I'm a jeweler and I want to use ethically produced materials.
It's probably a longer conversation. He can definitely email us at info@brilliantearth.com and I'd be happy to follow up with him after the show.
Here's a listener who says, do your guests need volunteers? I mean, there are people who might want to sign up and help you. Just the websites are on our website. So kqed.org, they'll be on our website and you can find out more information and go and seek. Here's Greg who says, the mobile internet needs to be expanded in the developing world to allow smartphones to enhance work as tools. Is there a global initiative to help with this? Anybody know? John Elkington? You know?
I'm sure there is. I don't know of it.
Well, somebody may know, and if you do, you can email us directly, forum@kqed.org, perhaps before the program ends. Well, in the meantime, go to more of your calls. Tyler, you're on.
Yeah, hi. Great program. I work for or manage a local sustainable San Mateo County. And one of the things I've been keeping my eye on and just been very interested in, and perhaps the group or John, the gentleman from sustainability, can speak to this, is the not only entrepreneurship trend, but also the intrapreneurship trend. Individuals going into companies and really affecting positive change within existing companies. And I'd just be interested to hear some comments on that.
John? Okay.
Well, I'll give you an example, Tyler. One of the companies that we've worked with now, I think, for about 9 years, and at times it's been highly frustrating, has been the Ford Motor Company. It was Bill Ford who brought us in the first place. And it's frustrating because getting very big incumbent companies like that to change is really, really tough. But to give you an example of a social entrepreneur, there's a guy there that we've worked with off and on for quite a number of years, Dave Burdish, who's now running a sort of sustainable mobility project within Ford, but doing it in places like Mexico and South Africa. And what they're trying to develop is a set of mobility solutions that don't necessarily involve providing cars, or if they do, they'll be electric cars or something that is a little bit more sustainable than what Ford normally offers. Now, when this started, it was a pretty much a sideline show, but over a period of time, it's got more and more oxygen from Ford because they're beginning to realize that city administrations in other parts of the world, particularly in megacities, are now desperate to have something other than the private motor car as the answer to getting people around.
Let me thank Tyler for the call, and we'll go next to a caller in Vallejo. Jerry, you're on. Morning.
Yes, hello. And Michael, I love your show. I enjoy it just about every day.
Thank you.
My question is, and actually I was going to type an email, but I'm glad to be on the air. And this is the crux of it. I don't think that many non-Muslims are aware of the Islamic restrictions on borrowing or lending money with interest. You can't, if you are a devout Muslim, you can't get a mortgage in this country. You cannot allow yourself to either accept or to pay interest. And I would like to know how these folks that you have there, how are they getting around this in Muslim countries? I mean, the royal families, you know, buy and sell and take interest like crazy. They seem to somehow get around it. But the common people are told that they cannot accept and they cannot charge.
Well, I know, Matt Flannery, you've encountered some of this. You want to comment?
Yeah, we've definitely encountered that. And the microfinance movement has struggled with that. And right now, Kiva works in Lebanon. Kiva works in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, and a bunch of West African countries that have Muslim populations. The way they've been able to pull that off is by sort of redefining the way a loan is paid back, and not charging interest per se, but charging fees, having a fee structure which makes a loan profitable for the lender without actually charging interest per se.
And I thank the caller, and you're listening to Forum, and we're talking with Matt Flannery, Stephanie Bernstein, Eric Grossberg, and John Elkington, all about social entrepreneurship. And as you may well be aware, this is Pledge Week for KQED Public Radio. So for more information about how to support KQED, you simply need to go to kqed.org. We're going to continue for Sirius Satellite listeners who are listening to us. But in the meantime, we want to let you know about Pledge, and we want to let you know about how you can support KQED, which we indeed hope you will do. Remind you that this program is live, but there is an hour repeated in the evening at 10 p.m. from 10 to 11. I'm Michael Krasny. Again, this is KQED in San Francisco. Let me go to more calls for serious listeners, and we'll go to Harvey in Berkeley. Harvey, hi.
Michael, and hello to your wonderful guests. I have an idea for green financing worldwide, and it would be the clean energy combo. This would be a package deal where you get a solar electric rooftop and a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle or electric vehicle in one package, and the financer takes care of all the rebates, the tax incentives. All you have to do is sign on the line, and you got your clean energy. You don't have to worry about the rising price of gas and the rising price of electricity anymore, and it really makes the payback on the roof really fast because you're not only powering your home but your car as well.
John Elkington, what's your response to Harvey's pitch?
I think it's a great idea, and some elements of it already you can see in different parts of the world. So, for example, if you go to Australia, there's a guy called Nick Francis who developed social enterprise, which basically involved more there giving away compact fluorescent light bulbs, water-efficient technologies, and so on. Unfortunately, it was undermined by some fairly substantial changes in the state government incentives for all of this to happen, although the new Kevin Rudd's new government is about to change all of that back again. But Nick Francis has gone on to set up something else, Cool Energy, which is, for example, active in my own country of the UK. And they've just linked up with one of the really major newspapers and given away millions of bulbs, compact fluorescent bulbs. So as I say, these are building blocks. What I think Harvey's suggesting is a step beyond that, and it's a way of bundling a series of lifestyle choices for people and making them easier. I think it's a great idea.
Thank you, Harvey. Good luck. Harvey's been calling in about solar ideas, I think, as long as I've been here in public radio. The global reach of this social entrepreneur movement, I mean, we've been talking about it to some extent, but like, for example, when you compare the UK to the United States, to other European countries, or for that matter, in the developed world per se, what are we talking about? The U.S. leading in this sort of thing now?
The U.S. paradoxically has a pretty high concentration of social entrepreneurs. Brazil is another country that has very considerable numbers. The UK is another one. It falls off across much of the continent, the European continent. But
in Canada, where Eric gets his
fewer,
diamonds from,
I'd say fewer. But I think if you look at India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, you'll find again another very big concentration of these people. China, you don't find them. Japan, you don't find them very much. So to some degree, it's still a cultural issue. And as Matt was talking about some of the Islamic countries, you find a growing proportion coming through there as well, but it's at a lower level so far.
And much of it at least in the United States, here in the Bay Area.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the nine Bay Area counties or throughout the Bay Area. Well, I want to find out from each of these young social entrepreneurs that we've gathered here this hour about where they're going next. Matt Flannery, where do you see Kiva going?
Well, we're just trying to catch up to sort of a burst of activity we had. We're going from an organization that a year ago was about seven people to now is 25 people, opening an office in Nairobi, Peru, various parts of the world where we can maintain a better control and better customer service for the people we work with. So we're really growing up from a small .com that was around a kitchen table to an international NGO.
It's exciting. Eric Rosberg.
I see us continuing to lead the charge for ethical origin diamond jewelry. So the industry is starting to understand some of the issues that we've been talking about for a long time, and I think we'll continue to lead the pack and grow from there and hopefully get the word out.
A lot of it is marketing, isn't it? I mean, getting the word out and making people just aware that you're on the map.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. Stephanie Bernstein?
Well, we're growing in a few different ways, and a lot of that has come from a demand for non-plastic food containers. A lot of people are moving away from plastics because of how toxic they are to produce, the short lifespan they have on this earth, and how toxic they are when they're thrown away. So we're trying to bring over more sizes of our stainless steel food carriers. A lot of it's moms who've been asking us for that. We're also expanding, as much as the manufactured goods and the variety is important to us, we've wanted to scale also the social impact we can have. So we've, as I mentioned earlier, we're working with a new NGO project in India. And this group, again, works with a slum project. They collect plastic and turn it into material. We're doing a new utensil holder we'll launch in a couple of weeks made of that.
Quick question that Dan Zoll, who's producing this morning's program, wants to know, and that is, do you suggest that people bring these containers to restaurants with them, and what kind of reaction do they get when they do?
They're actually met generally with very happy. I mean, not only do a lot of these businesses want to start to green themselves, but businesses pay a lot of money to give you containers to throw away, and I think it really helps them to feel also that they're not just giving away things for you to toss out. And yes, bring them to restaurants, bring them everywhere.
Well, congratulations to all three of you on your success and continued success to you, and commendations for the work that you're doing. Again, we're talking to three young Bay Area entrepreneurs, Stephanie Bernstein, founder and CEO of To-Go-Ware, which makes reusable food and beverage containers and other products, and Eric Rosberg, co-founder and CEO of Brilliant Earth, an ethical diamond jeweler offering conflict-free diamonds, and Matt Flannery, co-founder and CEO of Kiva.org, a person-to-person micro-lending website. Also thanks to John Elkington, co-founder and chief entrepreneur of Sustainability. His book, again, co-authored with Pamela Hartigan, is The Power of Unreasonable People, How Social Entrepreneurs Create Markets That Change the World. Our thanks to all of you, our listeners. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.